got something in my eye. Thank y'all very much. So we're going to be back in John 8 this morning. We're going to be looking at verses 31 through 36, if you want to turn there. You know, chapter 8 is a unique chapter in John's gospel. The content that we see in chapter 8 is really the last conversation that John gives us between Jesus and the Jewish leaders. The next time all these guys get together in Jerusalem will be the last week of Jesus' life. And there won't be a lot of friendly dialogue between them then. Now, if you were here last week, and most of you were not, we talked about authority. I'm sorry, I couldn't. We talked about authority, Jesus' authority specifically. We looked at the previous verses where Jesus declares himself to be the light of the world. And his old buddies, the Pharisees, they heard that, they didn't like that, and they started to criticize Jesus based on the grounds of authority. Because they did not believe that Jesus had the authority to make the claims that he was making, especially all these bold claims about himself. They thought that if what Jesus was saying was true, then there should be other people also validating Jesus' words. The problem with that was they were misreading and misunderstanding Jesus' intention. You see, when other folks would claim to be what Jesus claimed to be, they were usually trying to recruit folks to join their little movement, which was almost always a political movement. They wanted to drive out the Roman occupation of their homeland, and if they couldn't do that, they at least wanted to grow a force big enough so that they could have some bargaining power with the Jewish leaders. So all these guys before Jesus, they had some type of military or some type of political motivation to the things they would do and the things they would say. And Jesus wants nothing to do with any of that. That's not why Jesus is here. The reason Jesus was trying to draw as many folks to himself as he could was so that he could show them the Father, so that he could explain to them the Father. Everything Jesus did and said was from the Father. Everything that Jesus did and said was done for the glory of the Father. So when the Pharisees wanted to know what authority Jesus had, well, Jesus just pointed them to the Father because that's what he did. That's what he did. When Jesus came, he came because the Father sent him. He said what the Father told him to say. He did what the Father told him to do. Jesus did not need random witness testimony to validate him because the Father was Jesus' witness to the world. And since the Father is Jesus' authority, that means everything that Jesus says, everything that he gives us to do as his followers, everything he tells us to say as his disciples is not up for negotiation because it comes from the highest possible authority. And all that stuff Jesus said in the previous passage, in verses 12 through 30, I think, it all sets up today's passage. It sets it up perfectly. The passage that we're going to look at today is built on verses 12 through 30. So let's read this passage. We'll start at verse 30 just to connect the two together. Verse 30 of John chapter 8 says, "As he was saying these things, many believed in him. So Jesus said to the Jews who had believed him, 'If you abide in my word, you are truly my disciples, and you will know the truth, and the truth will set you free.'" Okay. Abide, disciple, truth, freedom. That's the order of progression. If we're wanting to be more like Jesus, if we're wanting to please him and grow in grace, we abide, we learn, we discover truth, then we can live the way that God intended for us to live, which is free. Like our friend Paul told the churches in Galatia, it was for freedom's sake that Christ set you free. All people everywhere were meant to live free But real freedom isn't just the capacity to do whatever you want. Freedom is the ability to live as God intended for you to live. Free from lies and manipulation, free from destructive habits that hurt you and the folks you care about, free from false identities and being seduced by false gods. And Jesus has made a way for us to live that way again. We abide, we learn, we discover truth, and we can live free. So let's look at each step of that process. I think this is important. There's a real danger in reading the same things over and over again, because the more times you read it, you kind of get numb to it. You know what I mean? It's like you read over something so many times, it kind of loses its initial impact that you felt the first few times you read it. I think the Bible's a lot like that. Doesn't mean you should not read it, okay? Let me throw that out there. But I'm just saying, these Jesus' words sometimes are so simple that we don't pick up the deeper meaning of his words. So the first step that Jesus gives is actually belief, right? Jesus was sharing all of this with the Jewish leaders he was talking to who believed in him. That's what verse 31 said. So first, we need to believe. We believe Jesus' words, and then we abide. Now, abide is a peculiar word. It's one that you don't hear much outside of church circles, though. It's kind of like exalt. When's the last time you told your daughter to exalt her brother, right? We don't do that. But abide just means to stay, to remain. It's not renting an Airbnb for a few days. Abiding means you bring all your junk with you, you unpack all of it, you hang up your pictures, you put your kids' coloring pages on the refrigerator, you do all of it. You make that place your home. When Jesus says, abide in my word, that's what he means. To make his word our home. Because only through abiding can we really be his disciples. That's what he said. And I know we don't use the word disciple much anymore, unless we're talking about cults or biker gangs. But it's a word we need to get familiar with again. Because when Jesus gave his great commission in Matthew 28, he said to go into the world and make disciples, right? Not followers, not converts, disciples. Jesus did not say go into all the world and lead people to the Lord, did he? No, he said make disciples. Because disciples abide. They abide because they believed. It really bothers me. And it might be because I just don't understand it. But as a church pastor, this happened this past week. I get asked pretty often, well, how many baptisms did your church do last year? Decisions for Christ, whatever that means, did y'all have last year? And on one hand, I get the questions. Because as humans, we love to measure things. We love to track things. It's what we do. So I understand the questions, but I don't like the premise of the questions. I don't like them because everything Jesus does not fit neatly into a category, okay? Like some of you, I have been with Legacy from the beginning. You know what that means? I know stuff. I know that a large number of people who have come through this fellowship over the years or are currently part of this fellowship have been deeply wounded. I know a lot of them were wounded by other churches. And they came here because they didn't want to go back there, but they realized they needed to be somewhere. And some of them stayed here to heal up, and then they moved on. But you know, a lot of them were either too hurt to serve the church right away, or they were too bitter over what happened to them to really contribute much to the life of the church. And y'all, that is okay. That is perfectly okay. Sometimes people need space more than they need to serve in ministry. And I really believe that God knew that we would give people the space they needed to work through their hurts. And at the same time, we would also do whatever we could to help them to reconnect to the real Jesus. Not that Jesus they saw back wherever they came from. Now, do some people take advantage of that? Yes, because that's what people do. Does that mean we should stop doing that? No, because that's not what God's church does. But we did this so people could become Jesus' disciple again, so they could abide in him again. And it cost us a lot over the years. But y'all, churches and denominations specifically don't have categories for things like that. But that doesn't mean we don't do things like that. I mean, would that mean that everything God did for all those folks over the past years doesn't matter because you can't quantify it and put it on a spreadsheet? I'm sorry, I don't see things that way. I really don't. And while we're at it, maybe I shouldn't say this. It's been a rough few weeks. I don't think Jesus is very happy with a lot of our churches today. And you know the pain that causes me to say out loud to you sweet folks? Is he happy with ours? I hope so. But y'all, Jesus came for the broken. And in a lot of our churches, even here in this county, it's getting really hard to find the broken people. Because everybody wants to look polished and presentable. They want to act like everything's okay. Life is just great. Mama's got her hair all did up. Dad's wearing the latest pair of Skechers. I mean, we almost brag about how busy we are, how involved in everything our kids are. It's like presenting this image of wholeness and prosperity is more important than looking for and finding the broken people. And so when the broken people do show up, because it's hard to drive 100 yards in this county and not hit a church. So when the broken people do show up and all they see is polished and presentable, a lot of them start to think, maybe there's not a place for me here. Y'all, just because we're saved does not mean we're whole. I'm sorry, you are not there yet. The process of being made whole, of becoming like Jesus, is just that. It's a process. It does not happen in a moment of time. It happens over the course of a lifetime as people who remain aware of their brokenness, who remain aware of their need for Jesus. They keep leaning into him. They keep abiding in his word. They're growing in grace. They're asking Jesus to use them and help them to be more like him. And y'all, a big part of being like Jesus is looking for the broken people. But that's not the majority of our churches today. It's just not. Our churches are spending $250,000 on sound systems. And y'all, that is not in Atlanta. That is not even in Athens. That is right here in Madison County. Yeah, you would love that, wouldn't you, brother? This building was barely $250,000. How many poor people could you feed for $250,000? How many single moms could you help with $250,000? That grieves me in places I don't feel a lot of times. That's in the bones. And y'all, I'm open to being wrong about these things. Okay, let me say that. I know I'm a moron, and there's a lot of things I get wrong. But with so much affluence in our churches today, and the spectacles that a lot of them have become, I do not understand how the Jesus in the Gospels could be okay with that. Again, I am open to being wrong. I just don't see it. The Great Commission was not to go into all the world and build multi-million dollar worship centers, okay? It was to go and make disciples. And just because 500 or 1,000 people are sitting in your $5 million building, hearing you through your $250,000 sound system, does not mean you're making disciples. Now, I hope you are. Maybe you are. I hope you are. I also hope that you're not so busy feeding the machine that you neglect to feed the sheep. Because as someone who's been here from the beginning, we have seen a ton of that, haven't we, Pastor? The shepherd's loyalty is to the sheep, not to the machine. I'm sorry. Y'all, Jesus wants disciples. And Jesus tells us that believing, that's first. And after we believe, abiding, or how we become his disciples. We believe his words because they're true. And we make our home with him. And because we're his disciples, we learn from him. We learn what truth really is. We learn that for a disciple, truth goes beyond facts and accuracy. Truth is a person. But truth is not personal. Let me explain that. Truth is an expression of God's character, okay? It's not something we decide for ourselves. It's something we are shown. It's something we are given. And God has given us truth. He has told us what that is in his word. He has also shown us what truth is in his son. So if anything we encounter or anything we imagine contradicts God's word or opposes God's son, it cannot be truth. Now, we hear a lot these days about your truth and my truth, and all that's groovy as long as it lines up with his truth. If it agrees with his truth, call it whatever you want to. But y'all, this isn't anything new. This goes back to the garden when Eve decided that she was going to live her truth and did something that God told her not to do. There are no new sins, okay? Nothing is exclusive to any particular generation or ideology. Millennials are not the first generation to leave the church in droves, okay? Same-sex marriage advocates were not the first ones to push back against God's sexual ethic. Now, these are more recent, they're more familiar, but they are not original. And they will not be the last ones either. Like Solomon wrote, there is nothing new under the sun. What has been is what will always be. And if that sounds discouraging, just remember that a day is coming where that will no longer be the case. Because sin had a beginning, therefore it will have an end. What will not end is truth. Because truth did not have a beginning, therefore it cannot have an end. Truth is timeless because it's the expression of a timeless being. It is reliable and consistent. It is faithful because God is all of those things. That's why truth sets us free. It's why it's the only thing that can, because everything else is unstable and temporary. Truth is not. If something was true 1,000 years ago, it's going to be true 1,000 years from now. Again, let's not confuse truth with facts, because facts change based on available information, right? I mean, the earth used to be flat, remember? And I know some folks still think it is, and they got some great YouTube videos. They're fantastic. They make some really compelling arguments. But y'all, facts will change based on available information. Truth does not. It cannot, because God never changes. And it's that unyielding wall that does not move. It's that anchor in safe harbor that always holds firm. That is what allows us to live free. We don't need to live like the world lives anymore. We should not live the way the world lives, because the world is still looking for truth. They're trying to define it. It's why they make stuff up and they attack traditional meanings of things, latching on to these ideologies and strange social narratives. They're looking for truth. They're looking for something solid, because everything else in their life is just shifting sand. They're trying to build their own solid rock, but that's not how rocks work. They're found. They're not made with human hands. I'll give you an example. Same-sex weddings. Someone I worked with was recently invited to a same-sex wedding, and his wife thought they should go because she'd been close to this family for a long time. And so he came to me. He told me that he felt uneasy about all of it, and he wanted to know what I thought. It's like, great. So the first thing I asked him was, are you a Christian? He said, yes. Okay. Next question, is your wife a Christian? He said, no. I said, this is going to be a problem. This is going to be a problem. Because her reason for wanting to go and your reason for not wanting to go are not governed by the same authority. You see, we're back to authority again. Authority is underneath everything. And they do not have a shared authority. And I'm going to be real honest with you. If I was not a believer, I would totally support gay marriage. 100%. Why wouldn't I? If two consenting adults decide they want to enter a legal union, a monogamy, with legal protections, why would that bother me? That is not my business. But, big old but here, y'all. If I am a believer, and not just on Instagram, but if I'm a real believer, like a real disciple of Jesus, what I want, what I think does not matter. I cannot affirm a same-sex marriage. I certainly should not attend a ceremony and give the impression that I do. And y'all, this has nothing to do with the couple wanting to get married, okay? This is a defense of truth based on authority. It has nothing to do with the people involved. I want to say that again. If that same-sex couple invites you to a dinner party or a barbecue and you want to go, go. Go and enjoy yourself. If they're having a bunch of friends over to watch the Super Bowl and you want to go, well, you go make your best buffalo chicken dip and you go to that party. If Jesus was here and he got invited to that, I really think he would go. But he's not going to that wedding. And neither should you. And I'm going to tell you why. If I belong to Jesus, I keep repeating myself here. If I belong to Jesus, Jesus is my authority, right? We talked about that last week. If Jesus' word, which is truth, because it is an expression of his character, if it informs me what his intentions for marriage are, which it does, and if it shares with me the mystery of what marriage is meant to represent, which is Jesus' union with his bride, right? That's what marriage represents. And if I take that mystery of gospel union that marriage represents and I combine it with all the honor and the reverence that I'm supposed to have for it, and I communicate that same reverence and that same honor for this same-sex union, which I would be doing with my presence at that wedding, then I have dishonored God's truth about marriage. And I have dishonored God's Son by ignoring the sacred mystery of gospel union. This is much bigger than people. This is cosmic. If I do this, It's because I've decided that God is not really my authority. I am. Which is exactly, not kind of, not a little bit like, which is exactly what happened in the garden that made all of us slaves to sin. There is nothing new under the sun. It all just gets repackaged for new generations. It is the same sin. It is the same darkness that has been preying on God's people forever. I'm going to stop there. I didn't get to where I wanted to. Sorry about that. We'll pick up verse 33 next week. There's just too much good stuff in chapter 8. I don't know what it is. But speaking of good stuff, today is Communion Sunday here at Legacy. You don't need to be a member of Legacy to partake, but you do need to be a Christian. If you're not, this has no meaning for you. It's stale crackers and old juice. You're not missing anything. Okay? I want to read from 1 Corinthians 11, where Paul talks about what this is. He says, "For I received from the Lord what I also delivered to you, that the Lord Jesus, on the night when he was betrayed, took bread, and when he'd given thanks, he broke it and said, 'This is my body, which is for you. Do this in remembrance of me.' In the same way, he also took the cup after supper, saying, This cup is the new covenant in my blood. Do this as often as you drink it in remembrance of me. For as often as you eat this bread and drink the cup, you proclaim the Lord's death until he comes. Whoever therefore eats the bread or drinks the cup of the Lord in an unworthy manner will be guilty concerning the body and blood of the Lord. Let a person examine himself then, and so eat of the bread and drink of the cup. For anyone who eats and drinks without discerning the body eats and drinks judgment on himself."